Okay, we're going to go ahead and call the House Finance Committee to order today, March 1st, about 1:38. For the record, we have with us Representative Moses, Representative Holm, Representative Kelly's excused, Representative Foster, Representative Co-Chair Schnultz was here, he'll be back. Vice Chair Stoltz is here, Representative Hoffer's here, and Representative Jewell. Okay, on today's schedule, what I'd like to do before we take up the discussion on Amarillo Hess is just finish one bill that we held over from yesterday, and we do have Representative Corning here with us. So let's go ahead and take up House Bill 35, and then we'll go right into the discussion and overview of Amarillo Hess. Representative Corning, if you want to join us, please. Representative Corey.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. It's good to see you in person as opposed to testifying from Wasilla, which just seems to be kind of a growing habit for me because I often am traveling back to the district. But I won't go over the whole legislation as I did yesterday. I don't think there's any point in doing that since you folks are familiar, having heard the bill yesterday. So basically, I'm just here to say that if you would consider this amendment, that would be appreciated. However, it's not something I'm going to fall over a sword on. I'm not going to jump on the roof and go up on the roof and jump off if this doesn't occur. We still have a good bill without that, but what I'd like to do is to perhaps let those within the industry that are here to testify on this bill justify this amendment, and if you folks see fit to pass it based on their rationale, then that would be good. If not, then the bill in its current form would be fine.
So, very good. Well, we don't want you to jump off the roof.
Thank you. And, of course, the amendment to Mr. Chairman, excuse me for interrupting, I'm just going to remind folks or reiterate that the amendment just simply adds a it doesn't really add one person to the board because that person's already on the board. It just simply makes that person, which would be a landscape architect, a voting member of the board. And that's justified based on the fact that it's a growing industry. For example, back in, I think it was 2001, 5 years, 4 years ago, there were six licensed landscape architects in the state, and now there's 30. So it seems to be a growing industry, and therefore they feel they want to have a greater representation in the form of a voting member on the board.
Okay. Very good. Well, why don't we go ahead and move the amendment so we can discuss it.
Would you like the amendment moved,
please,
Mr. Chairman?
Mr.
Chairman, I would move amendment, unnumbered amendment, but if I may suggest it's amendment number one. Bannister offered the House to House Bill 35.
Very good. Thank you. Object? Is that right?
Three times now.
Okay.
Serious.
Yeah, he's serious. All right.
I can move.
Okay. Been moved and objected. Discussion. You've already discussed it somewhat. Yes. Do you want Mr. Keto now to
absolutely
discuss it?
Please to defer to him.
Okay. Let's see. For the record, before I forget, Representative Weirach has joined us as well as Representative Croft. Keto, welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sam Keto III. I'm the chair of the Legislative Liaison Committee for the Alaska Professional Design Council, and we are here today to speak in favor of the amendment. We're doing that on behalf of the Architects, Engineers, and Land Surveyors Board. The board took a vote about a week and a half ago that supported converting the temporary landscape architect position into a permanent position. This move actually would create a situation on the board where there are now an odd number of boards, so we'd avoid ties in any kind of a split vote situation. And it follows through with one of the legislative audit recommendations. I'd be happy to answer questions.
Any questions from Mr. Keto? Okay. Seeing none. Why don't you just stay put, though, for now. Representative Holm, did you want to discuss your objection?
Or yeah, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. If you recall, yesterday I discussed a number of issues that with regards to landscape architects and the difficulty within the state of Alaska with having people certified as a landscape architect. It's completely different being certified as a landscape architect in Alaska than it is being certified a civil engineer. The two are not synonymous with one another, and I'd like to make the point that in the state of Alaska, we have a number of different growing zones, and those zones that we grow in are not given the due. We don't have the book, if you will, that sits down and says, in this different area, this is what you do. In this area, this is what you do, and so forth and so on, like you do for electrical or for structural engineering or any of those different fields. And because there isn't any Bible, if you will, to deal with, I'm objecting to the idea that there is somehow someone given a license here in the state of Alaska to designate what types of products are used in different areas without the knowledge in the background in order to be able to do it appropriately. And I don't think under this I don't know if I'm against having a landscape architect on the board particularly. That's not really what my point is. I'm not against landscape architects. It's just whether or not they have the opportunity to have the knowledge or even have the ability to get the knowledge, if it's even available, to make the proper judgments without a lot of anecdotal information. And at this juncture, I think the state of Alaska is a little premature in doing this, and I don't speak about this very lightly. As you said, that as I understand, we went from 6 to 10. Well, I remember when there was none, and it wasn't that long ago. And the problem is just because we get more and more people that claim to be experts in a field doesn't mean they are. And I really have a problem with this scenario because there is no Bible that tells them what to do in the state of Alaska. If you could comment, Mr. Keto.
Through the chair,
Representative Holm, thank you. Yeah. Mr. Keto, before you comment, I'd like to ask Ms. Davidson to join you too. With the alleged audit. Thank you. Mr. Keto, go ahead and respond.
Through the chair, Representative Holm, I think you have raised some interesting and valid points, and I don't actually have a suggestion for a solution at this time. I do know that through the licensure process, the landscape architect was put on there in a temporary capacity to help transition into the stage where we ended up with a stable licensure procedure, and we do have the stable licensing procedure for landscape architects now. How they get licensed or what knowledge base that they utilize in order to get licensed is beyond my knowledge. So I'm sorry, I can't answer beyond
through the
that.
Chair, thank you very much for that. Well, that's my point. My point is that you don't have a licensure procedure. And the one that you have, I would respectfully promote is inappropriate, that it does not have. You know, it's not like an awful lot of other things that we do in this state. We do not have the book that says providing good landscape architecture in Juneau is commensurate with that which is in South Central, which is the same as it's in Fairbanks, which is the same as in Barrow or Kotzebue or Nome or any other place in the state. And so since we don't have that group of folks in the industry who have provided this information. And I'll give you an example of why I'm saying this. There is an Association of American Nurserymen, which has a book out which has the standards for all of the activities that we do as American Association of Nurserymen members. But in that book, there is nothing that specifically is related to Alaska. Well, Alaska isn't anything close to anything to the rest of the United States, as we all know. And because of that, and then because we don't have an Alaskan Association of Nurserymen, we don't have the industry in concert with government at a point yet to where landscape architects do have the background where they can say, I'm an expert in the field of, quote, what grows in zone 1, zone 2, zone 3, or whatever. And I understand because it's written down here, this is what grows in these areas. And this project's located in this area, and therefore I can translate my knowledge from some standard of some sort and put it over on a project. And that's really what we're looking at here, is we're looking at being able to take information and categorically superimposing it over a project. Is that not correct in your licensing procedures?
Through the chair, I...
That makes sense to you?
Yes, that does make sense.
Okay. Well, I guess so. My point is that if you do this and you say it's a person that's going to be on this board with a voting He's in essence, he or she, is in essence taking it upon themselves as being an expert in that field and therefore being able to make those categorical statements with regards to landscape architecture on these projects throughout the state. And I question the validity of that.
But I guess, I, through the chair, if I might, one of the things that I guess I can say, and as a civil engineer, I don't know all of the details of what it would take to become a landscape architect, but in our procedures, we do have manuals, books, and guidelines that tell us generally how we go about things, but in the matter of specifying specific materials, that's left up to knowledge of the local area. So you are correct in that landscape architects in Alaska should know about the local plant materials to be licensed. I don't know if that happens or if that does not. But I also believe that as a design professional that they would make a point of knowing that in order to be successful in their jobs in Alaska.
Okay. Well, I think the amendment is just basically
for adding the person.
Adding a voting member from, yeah.
Well, I guess I'll just register my...
Okay. I appreciate that.
Comments. Thanks,
Mr. Holmes. Thank you, Representative Holmes. Ms. Davidson, I wanted to ask you, in the audit report, it is a recommendation of the audit to add this person. Is that correct? If I'm,
yes, Mr. Chairman, it is.
Okay. And what was the rationale again? Same as what Mr. Keedle said?
Mr. Chairman, what we were looking at is landscape architects. There's a number of professions and occupations that are licensed under this board. Very different ones. Architects, engineers, land surveyors, just on the name. And therefore, you have representation of the different occupations on the board. Part of the rationale for adding this person as a full voting member of the board is this is the profession that's licensed under this board that is probably due to its age, the one that probably is more developing. It's still working on regulation projects. It's still going to be implementing, as Representative Holmes talked about, all the things that it needs to be to grow into a full-fledged accepted occupation in the state. And part of the rationale for putting this person on board as a full voting member is there should be at the board level a lot of activity with regard to this profession. And for that reason, we're making a recommendation that it be a full voting member, also in recognition that unless the legislature either acts to extend it as a non-voting member or a voting member, that seat does go away on June 30, 2005. And so it's a matter of trying to keep that occupation associated with the board to keep the evolution of its projects ongoing.
Okay, thank you. Representative Hopper.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Listening to this debate and debate offered the previous hearing on this bill, I guess I'm asking why, if, and again, admittedly, I mean, I'm hearing admission that this is a discipline in its infancy, not particularly well defined. What is the reason for Alaska recognizing a landscape architecture discipline? Why are we doing it?
Through the chair and Representative Hocker, I might make a stab at it. I was only briefly involved with this organization when the temporary position was put in place. My understanding was, as Representative Stoltz indicated yesterday, that there were some benefits to having licensure as a landscape architect in terms of being able to have Alaskan firms bid on federal projects. There's an outstanding question that the Landscape Architecture Association is responding to on that. There are a lot of developments over the past 20 years in regards to playgrounds, playground furniture, playground equipment, things that are pre-designed but need specific knowledge in order to be placed so that children aren't harmed. And those things involve a landscape architect. Things like, actually, I think most active landscape architects that I'm aware of spend a lot of time working on school playground projects where they're working on materials for the playground equipment to rest on, how they're anchored, and whether or not they're placed safely in the schoolyard. So those are specifically the issues that I'm aware of that receive benefit of having a landscape architect licensure in the state.
Sure. If I might follow on with a couple of questions. How many of these landscape architects are recognized in the state?
Through the chair, Representative Hawker, in Alaska right now, my understanding is there are 33 licensed landscape architects.
And in the sense, if they're we've got 33 recognized. There's certainly, I think I had a database of surveyors and architects, and it was like 3,000 people in the state. It seems to be a small number. Is it giving that particular discipline a seat on the regulatory board at this time, particularly as it's promulgating sort of the foundational regulations for this discipline? I'm looking for an opinion from you, recognizing if you know more. Is it premature?
Through the chair, Representative Hawker, I think my understanding is there are over 4,000 licensed civil engineers in the state. So there is a discrepancy in numbers, but there are also, at this time, 33 licensed mining engineers. And as far as members that are regulated by the board, all disciplines have some sort of representation: electrical engineers, civil engineers, architects, the public. And the landscape architects are licensed on the board, yet if they don't receive a voting position, they will not have a voice in how their regulations and their statutes get put together.
Concluding question. Mm-hmm. If we were to approve this amendment and put that position on the board, would the concerns registered by Representative Holm, do you feel that in any way the issues he has raised, would they be prejudiced by putting this person on the board? Say perhaps would this result in, sort of an unintentional consequence to the nurserymen of this state, that in some way their industry's professionalism, business, and judgment may be impaired or regulated in some way we're not intending?
Through the chair, I don't believe so. I do believe that having the landscape architecture position licensed provides the opportunity for that person to work with the other disciplines on the AELS board to try and formulate some guidelines for the practice of landscape architecture. I think that can provide a positive, and I think direction from this committee and from the legislature for the AELS board to do that, to address issues of practice and responsibility for landscape architecture, are appropriate.
So today, giving them the voice on the board through a vote wouldn't change the facts and circumstances in which the practice of either horticulture or landscape architecture is conducted in the state?
Through the chair, my understanding is no, it would not.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. Any other questions on the amendment? Representative Stoltz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Davidson, when looking through this sunset process, the termination process, did you look back at the original legislation and some of the debate, perhaps, to guide you in the original legislative intent and some of the compromises engendered in passing the original bill?
Through the chairman, Representative Stoltz, what we looked at is more the operations of today and where they are during the course of field work. I mean, we do go back and read it, but what we're looking at is how is it evolving and where is it today? So I wouldn't say there was anything on our part that give it any extraordinary weight to that.
I just I put my concerns on the record yesterday. I'll do it much more briefly today. There was a lot of concern about adding another regulatory entity, and it was presented in such a narrow scope. Be a non-voting member, and it will allow us to allow that profession to receive some small amount of federal work that they weren't eligible yet. And they weren't going to be interested in the regulatory functions, health, safety, and a lot of things that involve changing what you can and can't do as with your own yard, perhaps, or putting other regulations that we might be surprised at down the road. And I don't know. I don't know if you can definitely say it's not going to affect what nurserymen can do. You might find that one of their this board could very well regulate an activity that that profession's engaged in, and a lot of these boards tend to have closed shop type tendencies. They want to make sure they get the work. I can see. The nurserymen don't have a seat on that board, and I don't think they want one. Most of them are pretty busy as it is. And I just hate to see this creep of regulation. And it wasn't an uncontroversial measure. There was a lot of opposition, as you may remember, to it. I don't know if it's called a turf war or not, given the matter, but it's, I guess I'll just vote accordingly here.
Thank you, Representative Stoltz. Representative Holmes, do you still maintain your objection?
Before I answer that, I just wanted to make sure that I think both Representative Stoltz and Representative Hocker, I just spoke with him, understand my plight. And as a nurseryman, and having been in this business for 40 years, and having dealt with a number of landscape architects who were not originated in Alaska, and then now them coming up to Alaska, I have had a number of difficulties with these folks because they don't have the horticultural or historical knowledge in order to make good decisions based upon the projects here. When it comes to health and safety concerns, I don't know. They may make a good point that those things are important, but I would just caution the board that though I'm going to remove my objection, I'm going to be watching very closely what they do, because it is extremely difficult to take these contracts, and if you remember what happened originally, it was only for the purpose of allowing people to vote to bid on these projects, and from a historical perspective, that was a good thing. But now every project has a landscape architect who has to sign off on them. And in our area, and I assume it is in most urbanized areas today. So we used to have an old saying about the camel's nose is under the tent. Well, the camel's nose is under the tent, but this camel's a dromedary instead of Bactrian. And I want to make it a Bactrian. I want you to give the camel another hump that has the information behind it that's solidified so that they can then make just decisions so it doesn't hurt anybody in the industry. It, in fact, augments the industry. With that, Mr. Chairman, I remove my objection.
All right. Thank you, Representative Holmes. Okay. So, if there's no objection.
There is an objection.
There is?
Yeah.
Do you object?
Yeah, I guess I was too oblique, sir. I'd like to say I vote no on it.
Okay. Well, Representative Holmes had objected. He's
okay.
Removed his objection.
Okay.
So.
Well, just everybody pretend I voted no, and I'll vote no on the floor.
No, would you like
to
object?
That's fine. I'll remove my objection.
Okay. I apologize. I didn't. I had one objection on the floor, so. But if you want to object now,
No. Okay. We'll facilitate. I want to hear about Hammer on a Hiss.
Okay. All right. So we have Amendment 1 before us. We now have the bill before us. Is there any other discussion? Seeing none, Representative Foster.
Yeah, I'll go ahead and move. HB 35 out of committee with individual recommendations on the attached list.
Okay. Any objections? Seeing none. The bill passes. Thank you. Thank you. Mr. Davis, Mr. Keto, Representative Corn, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Madam
President. All right. Let's take a brief at ease as we prepare for the next bill review. Hey, we're back in order. House Finance. Next item that we're going to be taking up is the Amerita Hess Alaska Capital Corporation overview. My apologies. I knew this bill was coming to Finance, and so I scheduled a hearing, and it's now picked up a Judiciary Committee referral to, which, as I learn more about this, I think that's very warranted and justified. So we won't take any action on this bill today, but certainly we do want to have the overview and just to let people know we have on teleconference who will be speaking after the panel here. We have Mayor Bagage from the City of Anchorage, John Duffy, Manager of Metsu Borough, Diane Keller, Mayor of Wasilla, Gary Davis, Kenai Peninsula, John Combs, Mayor Palmer. So I think the plan, if I understand this, is you're going to give us the overview. I'll let you introduce yourselves. And you would like to do the interview or the overview first, and then go take people on teleconference here because they've been waiting. I'm sure they learned a lot about landscaping today. Which is and then we'll take questions and answers after your presentation, and we'll take the various city leaders' comments. Okay, with that, Ms. Fresca, why don't I just turn over to you? You introduce the panel to us, and we'll go from there.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We do appreciate your giving us the opportunity to a team approach to discussing our proposal. What we will do is we have Mike Burns is here from the Permanent Fund Corporation, and he will speak to the history of Amerita Hess. In terms of the structure of the proposal about how we would issue the bonds, Devin Mitchell and Tom Botan are here from the Department of Revenue. And then in terms of how we would propose to use the proceeds from these bonds, we have John McKinnon from DOT to speak to a number of the transportation projects because that is a significant share of the dollars that we have proposed in our capital budget. You do have a briefing packet of information that, if I could take a moment and just describe in terms of content, the first couple of pages are a background paper regarding the history of Amerita Hess and the settlement. Pages 5 and 6 are sort of a bullet summary of our proposed capital corporation with some schematics on page 7 and 8, we like diagrams. And page 9, 10, and 11, 12, Devin Mitchell will use as he talks about how the corporation would work and the financing. And then on pages 13 through 15, we have an opinion from Wilson Condon regarding what was the intent when this issue was before the courts and in terms of the state's pledge about putting the money in the permanent fund and isolating it so it did not count in the calculation of the dividend. And then 16, 17, 18 are what we're calling frequently asked questions, and then the following pages relate to the capital projects that we have proposed in our December rollout of our capital budget. We've used the bond proceeds from this mechanism as the fund source. And so in some of the summaries that you see of the capital budget, where it has a fund source code, it's code 2000, not the year, just the fund source code. Those are those projects that we propose to be funded by the revenue bond proceeds. And in terms of the history of the fund, I'll go ahead and ask Mike Burns, if that's okay, to talk about how we got the settlement.
And again, if you could just state your name again and your affiliation for the record, that would be helpful.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I am Mike Burns. I'm executive director of the Permanent Fund Corporation. As Cheryl mentioned, I'm going to give a brief background of how we got to where we are today. In 1977, the state of Alaska sued North Slope Oil Companies over royalty disputes. As you're aware, by the Constitution, 25% of all royalties are directed to the permanent fund. And so the issue became, in the courts, the whole concept of a runaway jury. Could the jurors be impartial? Could the judge be impartial? Because they were potential recipients of these royalty payments through the dividend. It ended up actually in the Ninth Circuit Court, and the court encouraged settlement. And in 1989 and 1991, the legislature passed legislation that stated that these earnings, as required by law, or not these earnings, any settlement would be deposited in the permanent fund but the earnings from those could never be used in the dividend formula. And that satisfied the court on the whole runaway jury concept. And in reality, it never went to trial. They were all settled. Between 1992 and 2001, there were about $194 million deposited into the fund. Earnings on that money over the years has amounted to almost $153 million. Inflation proofing of the original principal is about $77.5 million. So in the fund today is about $424,399,000. They mentioned Wilson Condon's memo in there. He uses the delicate term financial sequestration. I prefer the concept that this fund within the fund economically and financially is a self-licking ice cream cone, and it has no use. Is being used for nothing at this point. And I would like to just walk you through how we do figure our accounting, or how we do our accounting for income at the fund. First, we start with the very basic income, which is bond interest, dividends from stock, rents from our properties, and miscellaneous revenues from securities lending, commission recapture, etc. We add to that appreciation or depreciation on our assets. We subtract operating expenses of the fund, and we also subtract any other legislative appropriations to the fund. This gets us to a number that we refer to as our accounting net income, or a total return. From that, we deduct unrealized depreciation on assets. This gets us to realized net income. From that number, we subtract any income that's attributable to the Amerada Hess Fund. This gets us to the statutory net income, and that is the number that is used in the calculation of the dividend. With that background, I would like to answer any questions, or we can hold those till later.
Why don't we continue on with the discussion here, Mr. Burns? Thank you.
Okay, and next, Devin and Mitchell and Tom Botan will speak to the structure of this proposal. In terms of the best news is that it is not expected to impact our debt rating, so structure matters here.
Okay, very good. Go ahead.
So we were charged with the task of determining a manner in which this unused portion of money in the permanent fund could be used. We went through several iterations before we came up with what will be before the committee, which consists of two fundamental ideas. First, that there will be a new account created, a sub-account in the earnings reserve that will be called the Alaska Capital Income Account, which will be funded from earnings of this segregated portion of the fund, and then that there will be a new public corporation, which the public corporation will have the authority to issue up to $350 million in bonds of the corporations that will be supported by operating leases that might be paid from the Alaska Capital Income Account. The key need or reason for needing this separate corporation was to have a structure where we segregate this from the state's general credit and allow for the leveraging without any impact on the state's general credit ratings, and we have had initial discussions with credit analysts that track the state and confirmed that this is initially a structure they would consider self-supporting. The corporation would exist within the Department of Revenue and be funded by revenue staff. There would be a slight increment in operating for the corporation's annual audit functions and other administrative functions. The bond structure that we were contemplating is very critical to the viability of the corporation and the idea, in as much as we need to have a very flexible structure to be able to deal with potential volatility on the other side of the equation. We were looking at a 40-year nominal interest structure with a final bullet maturity, which is like a balloon payment at the term of the 40 years with the flexibility to retire principal in the interim years as additional revenue might be available to the corporation. We were talking about a tax-exempt bond structure so that we would be taking advantage of the state's ability to fund projects on a tax-exempt basis. And we have a variety of other potential enhancements that we would incorporate into the transaction to ensure that we had maximum protection against volatility, since that's a major concern. The final credit feature that we were discussing that brings the foundation to the transaction is a debt service reserve fund, a fully funded debt service reserve fund that would be secured by a moral obligation pledge at the state of Alaska. If you look in your packets, the handout for today, there's a couple of flowcharts in there that help illustrate how these two ideas might work. If you look on page 7 of the packet, there's an Alaska Capital Income Account flowchart. And in that flowchart, it demonstrates how we have in the upper flow, there's the permanent fund with the Amaretta Hess segmented in the lower right-hand corner, where you can see earnings right now are just circling right back in and building Amaretta Hess principal annually, where you have realized earnings of the permanent fund proper going over to the earnings reserve account and then being funded out in dividends per the formula. The proposal would change nothing related to the permanent fund or the transfer to the earnings reserve or to dividends. It would change the Amaretta Hess arrow. Instead of circling around to itself and continually building principal, it would arrow over to the earnings reserve subaccount, the Alaska Capital Income Account, and be available for an annual appropriation for, in this case, in this schematic for Alaska projects, which would include transfers to the State of Alaska Capital Corporation. If you look on page 8, that's the schematic for the contemplated corporation that would be charged with issuing the $350 million in bonds. You have annual appropriations flowing into the corporation through a revenue fund that would be created. You would have the debt service reserve fund, which would be funded out of the revenue fund and have the moral obligation pledge associated with it. We have planned on an advance funded bond redemption account, which is called the bond redemption fund here. This is an added security feature so that we would, in essence, pay debt service or fund debt service into that account to the extent funds were available a year in advance. And so prior to any principal redemption through the flexible amortization on the bonds, we would have set aside an additional year's worth of security to further insulate the state from market volatility. There would also be an operating function or account off of the revenue fund that would provide for, as I indicated earlier, audit function, administrative duties of the corporation related to maintenance of the obligations of the corporation, and then in addition fund the construction fund if there were revenues available within the revenue fund for transfer. In the middle of this page, you see the corporate bond issue with a flexible amortization. That's the source of funding, the primary source of funding for the construction fund. It's not very easy to show in one spreadsheet due to some of the complexities, but that money would flow from investors to the construction fund and then from there be available for outflows to the various projects. The money appropriated into the revenue fund would be based on evergreen operating leases with the various benefactors of projects on the from the construction fund itself. There are some tables that follow on page 9, 10, 11, and 12 that illustrate a potential scenario based on certain assumptions. If you look on page 9, that's the Alaska Capital Income Account. It has the principal balance of the Amaretta Hess funding and some earnings assumptions, 7.61, which the Permanent Fund Corporation's consultants have provided to them as their their most likely scenario of an earnings rate for the short term, I believe the next 5 years. We actually had it decrease to 7% in 2017, just to try to have an example that's a little more conservative even than folks might expect. That spins off an annual transfer of approximately $33.5 million that would fund, if you look on page 10, fifth column over, lease appropriation received, that amount corresponds with the first table. This has a borrowing rate of 6%, which again we believe to be conservative based on the ability to fund these on a tax-exempt basis. Has a reinvestment rate on fund balance within the corporation proper of 2%, which is lower because it anticipates the short-term nature of that money and the liquidity needs that the corporation will have as far as expending that money. You can see a little bit of the nature of the flexible amortization. You have outstanding bonds shown, and this is a net funding of a construction account that would gross $343 million based on anticipated earnings in the construction account that's shown on page 12, I believe. But in any event, an outstanding bond amount of $326 million in 2006, it would have a nominal interest payment, annual interest payment of $19.5 million. The flexible principal payments don't start occurring until 2007 in this scenario, as you have the need to segregate money to fund up a reserve initially, and then we have fund balance maintained at a minimum of the nominal interest payment amount in the beginning balance column, which then correlates to outflows through the flexible principal payments. And in this scenario, the final debt service would actually occur in 2019. That's when the reserve would transfer back over to the corporation and you would see that final outflow. The intricacies of this spreadsheet it shows there being a final flow in 2020, but the reality, just because of the intricacies of the spreadsheet that we're dealing with. On page 11, that's just the reserve fund being reinvested at a rate of 4%, which it would have a slightly longer time horizon but still a quite low tolerance for loss, and so we wouldn't anticipate it would have the same type of earnings as the fund might achieve, but more greater than the corporation would achieve, and it would outflow money that would flow over to the corporation and be used to retire obligations of the corporation, and then the construction fund on page 12 reinvested at a rate of 3%. You could put potential outflows based on cash flows to date on that fund.
Okay, thanks, David.
Mr. Chairman.
You want to wait till the end?
Yeah, I'd like to, Representative Croft.
Mr. Chairman, Tom Bhutan, Department of Revenue. That's a pretty comprehensive look, I think. I'll just add, in addition to talking to the rating analyst to ensure that this structure wouldn't be included in the state general fund debt, we also worked very closely with bond counsel and special tax counsel on this structure to see that we could indeed have a tax-exempt debt issue. And then with the entire package, we went out and talked to the marketplace a little bit to make sure that we had a structure that would be accepted out there in the public finance market.
And you said yes.
Absolutely.
Okay, that's good.
Okay. And then next, what we'd like to touch on is how we propose to use the proceeds from the bonds. And as I mentioned earlier, $155 million of the proposed $340 million is for several road projects. We had two categories. We called them roads to resources proposals, as well as congestion relief or bottleneck busters, depending on where you are in the state, I guess. And John McKinnon is here to talk about that. But we also had another $74 million related to deferred maintenance and major renovation and repair. And the legislature, a couple of years ago, did a lot of work in terms of deferred maintenance needs of the state. And we took this as an opportunity to try to meet some of those needs because of an opportunity to have a little bigger capital budget with state funds than we've had certainly in a long time. and then another $71 million to match federal highway dollars and transportation dollars and earmarks, and then about $24 million for several University of Alaska projects, including the UAA Science Complex. So those were the major categories of the types of projects that we were proposing to fund. And we'll have John here who can speak to some of the road projects and why we were advancing the idea of using state funds for transportation projects instead of simply requiring using federal funds. And in 2002, you all passed a general obligation bond package, which provided the first time that, again, state funds, the chunks of state funds, would be used for road projects. And again, that relieved us of some of the federal requirements. So John is here to speak to that.
Thank you. Our task was to come up with a list of road projects throughout the state that that would fit into the criteria of resource roads, or as Chair referred to, bottleneck clusters, congestion projects. But there were some subcategories here too. There were some roads that that would benefit tourism access and potential tourism development. And on the resource side, there were some projects that came off a list developed about 3 years ago by DP on a survey they did of the transportation network on projects that were necessary to be in place for the gas line construction. Those particular projects on our list are a couple of the bridge projects up in the Fairbanks area. There were links in the transportation network to transport pipeline modules or whatever over the road system for gas line construction. In looking at the projects, you know, we came across a much larger list that had projects which were needed but weren't advanced that far on the scale. For one reason or another, they hadn't advanced very far on the scale, so they were a few years out. So we came up with projects that were badly needed, yet would benefit both in cost and delivery by using state funds. As you're probably aware, the federal program is a development project is a very linear, sequential process. And when you aren't constrained by their rules, you can come up with a concurrent process of doing multiple tasks at the same time to speed up delivery. When you speed up delivery of the project, you also reduce the cost of the project. So if you look at the list of projects we have on there, this was the refined list when we finally had a target number to shoot at for the total package, the list of projects we ended up with.
Okay, very good. Ms. Preska, should we go on and take the comments now from the various mayors that are online? And then you guys are all going to stay, right? We want to keep our mayors working here, so let's go ahead and go to Murphy O'Brien with the Matsu Borough.
Hi, thank you very much. The Matsu Borough, I'm the planning director for the Matsu Borough, and we are very excited about the prospect of getting some of these projects going. The Palmer-Wasilla Highway, the Bogart East Extension, and the South Parks Highway Alternative will all provide significant east-west connections that we need. There isn't a day that goes by that you haven't heard about the growth that's occurring out here. And this infrastructure will just greatly enhance our transportation system. So we're very excited that the state is proposing this this bond issue and encourage you to pursue it. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you, Murphy. Jane Dale, Palmer.
Hi, my name is Jane Dale. I'm with the City of Palmer, and the City of Palmer is also very interested in providing support for the projects in the Matsu Borough to relieve the congestion along both the Palmer-Wasilla Highway and provide a secondary route between Palmer and Wasilla. Everybody is aware that this area has nearly doubled in size between the 1990 census and 2000, and presently Palmer is growing at approximately 7%. Establishing a second route between Palmer and Wasilla will facilitate everybody utilizing the growing retail available in Wasilla and also accessing the growing technical and professional end in Palmer. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Jane. Jane, is John Combs, Mayor of Palmer, also with you, or were you speaking on his behalf?
I was speaking on his behalf.
All right. Thank you very much, Jane.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Let's go to Gary Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is Gary Davis in Kenai. I'm standing in for Mayor Bagley, who couldn't make it today. I'm the Road Service Area Director for the Kenai Borough, and we'd like to applaud the governor's effort in taking the initiative to put together this this bond approach. I can remember a couple of years ago, there was a building, a DOT maintenance facility building in Soldotna that 1950s era was built right on the Kenai River, and it was utilized for several years without a lot of environmental constraints about dumping asphalt and diesel and engine oil and stuff like that. And the only way we could get that with tight budgets, the only way we'd get that moved was through a bond initiative. So I'm quite familiar with the importance and value of bond initiatives. The Kenai Borough, of course, is primarily interested in the Kalaponski Beach Improvement road project that's included into the Department of Transportation. This road is in much needed repair and is an alternate access highway to the southern peninsula from the Soldotna area. It's been a part of the State Transportation Improvement Project program, which we know as the STIP, and has been on that for a number of years and has been delayed and set back primarily due to the federal highway funding questions relating to failure of the reauthorization of T21. So a lot of municipalities have seen real important projects in their areas set back. So one thing, when you have a proposal like this with a lot of projects that have estimates to them, and when the projects are fine-tuned, a lot of the dollars fall out. A $20 million project may end up 16 or 17. So I'd like to put a bug in the ear to both the governor's office and legislature. Any savings accrued should probably go to the Kenai Peninsula Borough projects. And I'm sure Representative Chenault's office has that list readily available to you. So, Mr. Chairman, thanks again for the opportunity to testify, and good luck in your deliberations on this proposal.
Thank you, Mr. Davis, or former Representative Davis. Representative Chenault does have quite a long list here of uses of that additional money. So, okay, is Mayor Begich back with us?
Yes, I am, Representative Meyer.
Okay, go ahead, Mayor.
Hey, thank you very much, and of course, I have a list too. I'd be happy to take any of those savings and talk to you about that. But again, I just wanted to comment generally on the bill, but really on the need. And many of you have already heard about the need, and Anchorage is becoming more and more congested, and we're pleased that there's some movement on the state end to help relieve some of this congestion within Anchorage. Right now, on a daily basis in Anchorage, is over 1 million vehicle trips made across our city daily, a higher and higher percentage coming from the commuters from the Matsu Valley coming into our city and then moving through the city. You know, and it is clearly becoming a problem not only for movement of traffic, but for commerce and also a safety concern for our area. The specifics for Anchorage in this proposal is what we call the Tudor and Lake Otis congestion relief package. There are a couple elements that are funded in this proposal, and along with that is the Glen Highway and McGraw intersection. But let me first speak to the Lake Otis and Tudor congestion relief package. In the governor's proposal, Tudor and McGraw intersection, which is critical to moving traffic on the new extended Abbott Road going to the south of Anchorage, that starts construction on the Abbott Road this July. So this Tudor and McGraw intersection improvement will be critical to help moving traffic in and out of that new corridor. Along with that is the extension of Dowling Road to the east of McGraw-Abbott Loop extension over to Lake Otis. That's in the governor's proposal, which we are very happy about because that also creates an opportunity for us to create another east-west corridor along and parallel to Tudor, which we think is important. The other piece, which was not included in this package, but we would be hopeful that if for whatever reason you do find savings, the one other piece to this Tudor and Lake Otis congestion relief package is the Lake Otis and Tudor intersection. This was not included in the package. It's one we had proposed. The city in its revenue bond our general obligation bond that's up April 5th has $7 million of local money, 50% of this project, which of course we would challenge any other community to match that. But we are looking for another $7 million to finish off that intersection. That would help solve the Lake Otis and Tudor congestion relief in total. Many of you of the Anchorage Caucus saw our report that we gave to you a couple weeks ago that shows just since 2000, the year 2000, over 500,000 square feet of office space was permitted in that area by Lake Otis and Tudor. Another 500,000 in new university hospital space, as well as other types of office is planned for that area in the very, very new future. Again, we like the Tudor and Bergrau intersection improvement. We like the extension on Dowling Road for the Tudor and Lake Otis area congestion relief package. But the third element, which we still think is important, is because of the growth, is the expansion to the Lake Otis and Tudor intersection, which would be another $7 million. The other piece that was in the mix was the Glen Highway and Bergrau intersection. This intersection improvement would really become an interchange. This is fairly critical for a lot of commuters going from the downtown Anchorage area or the Bowl or the center or midtown Anchorage to Eagle River, Rabbit Creek, but really the growing number going to the Matsu Valley. Many of those folks come into Anchorage to work, and as they come in, they get caught on that intersection there, and it's pretty well backed up coming in or going out. This project is pretty important. If we can get relief there, it will help free up another project, which is expansion of the 5th and 6th Avenue project that's been in a stall pattern because of this intersection issue, as well as a few others. All these projects, as you can imagine, for us are fairly important. They help relieve congestion and help move the city in solving some of its at least road transportation issues. There are more issues around transportation, but around the road issues are pretty critical. Let me, if I can, Mr. Meyer, I'll end there and just really say we're pleased there's some movement in regards to some state funding in regards to roads and congestion relief for Anchorage. We know there's debate over the funding mechanism. We're pleased that there is a funding mechanism at least started here. What I would caution is in the future, you know, congestion relief may be here or may be in Kenai or in Fairbanks or other areas. The issue of transportation are continually will be a problem if we don't have a long-term stable funding source to meet that need. As you know, 48% of our roads in Anchorage are state-owned. So we don't have a lot of dollars to put toward that project list because they are state-owned. We are putting forward a $44 million road bond for local roads this year, and that's about average for us. So, again, as this is a good step in the right direction, we're happy that there's some critical projects on the governor's list in this transportation package. We also know that there needs to be a long-term stable funding cycle for infrastructure road improvements. Let me end there, Mr. Meyer, and if I'm happy to answer any questions, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you, Mayor Bagage. And I think at this time what I will do is entertain any questions for the folks who are on the teleconference. We've heard from about four or five of you, and I know you guys are anxious to get back to work. So if there's any questions for the folks on teleconference. Representative Clark.
Yeah, just very briefly, I was trying to rationalize the numbers. In the governor's materials, it says $26 million for the Lake Otis and Tudor issue without funding the Lake Otis and Tudor intersection specifically. And they specifically list $7 million for the Tudor Road, McGraw Street intersection, and $17 million for the Dowling. And separately from that, Glen Highway being at about $30.5 million. But the 17 and the 7 were supposed to add up to $26 million, I thought. I just wanted to get both Cheryl or whoever's confirmation of the right numbers, and then Mayor Begich's confirmation of the need on those. Am I reading those wrong, Cheryl? 26 total, but I have a 17 and a 7.
Go ahead, Cheryl.
Through the chair, Representative Pop, I don't know what you might be looking at, but the materials that we have distributed show the $26 million figure, $7 million for Tudor and Bergah, and $19 million for Dowling East Extension.
Dowling at 19.
Yes.
The website had it at 17, and that's where I...
Representative Crawford, I can answer again about the need. I recognize, you know, we really have been working very closely with South Central DOT here, and to be very frank with you, we thought for sure that the Lake Otis and Tudor intersection would be part of that equation when presented in the full transportation package. I understand the arguments that, you know, there's only so much money to go around, but here's our problem on that intersection. We, in the package, I think, I'm pretty sure we that you got one that day when we were on the Saturday session with the Anchorage Caucus, we laid out that even with all these improvements that are planned and all the other improvements, you know, a Boniface connection or Lake Otis widening or any of those things, the fact is our north or south movement on Lake Otis and our east movement of traffic on Tudor continually go up. Matter of fact, in some cases up 30%, even without with all those improvements, unless we do this intersection, because the growth patterns are greater than I believe DOT recognized when they put the full plan together, and we've sent them that information that we gave to the Anchorage Caucus very recently because they had asked us to give us a preliminary of what we thought the growth would be in traffic movement in that area. And when we showed them these plans, I can tell you that there was it was some new information there, and we're hopeful that they are reviewing that. And you know, our commitment is a fairly high commitment. I don't know many communities that are willing to put up this magnitude on an intersection like this of $7 million of local money, and all we're asking for is an additional $7 million. And that will complete that whole congestion relief program there. And I can't stress enough, if you look at those maps, even with all this done, that intersection moving south on Lake Otis or east on Tudor is going to be still a severe problem. And it also was the number three intersection the truckers identified as a problem in a recent article. And the truckers are coming from downtown Anchorage, from the port, and they're going south, and what they will do is travel down Tudor, or they will travel down DeBar, and they cannot go down Lake Otis, so they come up you know, through other means, and the net result is they're coming through Lake Otis and Tudor no matter what, because they got to get to south to that big commercial area of Abbott and Abbott area. And so we have to get that intersection resolved. It's a safety problem. It has four times one of our highest accidents, four times as high as any other red light citations of any other intersection in Anchorage, and the third most dangerous intersection in accidents in the city.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, just very brief on that, because off the DOT, the DOTPUF website, Office of the Commissioner, they say best solution for midtown congestion, why don't you just drive around Lake Otis and Tudor? Why isn't that, Mayor Begich, a better proposal to just avoid it rather than the $7 million or $7 million from us and $7 million from you to fix Lake Otis and Tudor?
Well, that'd be great if you're coming north, coming down Lake Otis, and that new Dowling section was done, and you're going to the valley. But if you're coming from one of our fastest growing areas, and I know the chairman will recognize this, that area of south of Lake Otis and Tudor and the hillside area is a very fast growing area, in some areas high density. So as they travel down Lake Otis, and you want to get to downtown, or you want to get to midtown, the likelihood is you will veer at Dowling, or you will have to get to Tudor, or if you want to go to the medical center of our city, you're not going to go down Lake Otis, turn on Dowling, turn on McGraw, go through the university, then backtrack to the hospital. That's just not going to happen. And if you want to increase more pedestrian safety problems, increase the traffic going through the university area right next to all that housing and that campus housing that the state is building. You're just asking for more problems. And the fact is, most of the commercial development is closer to Lake Otis than it is to the McGraw segment, because most of that's been developed now. So it is in our, you know, the traffic counts you know, they tell the story. And right now we're getting cut through traffic, and they're going through neighborhoods, and they are avoiding that intersection. And once McGraw is done, sure, that will relieve the west going traffic, but it won't relieve the south and east traffic. Because people coming from Tudor, you know, that need to come down Tudor, they got to get somewhere, especially if they live between Tudor and Dowling or Tudor and Diamond.
You just want questions for the teleconference witness now?
Yes, yes.
Questions for these guys we can wait till later?
Yes, please. Yeah. Just so these guys on teleconference don't have to hang on any longer.
Okay, that's it. Thank you.
That's all. Okay. Seeing no other questions, you guys are free on the teleconference there. Certainly welcome to stay on if you want to.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. As you know, today's Tuesday for me, and you know what that means.
Oh, yes.
And so I have one of those members waiting patiently outside, so I appreciate the time, and I do look forward to any support in regards to traffic relief and congestion relief you can do. And, of course, the Lake Otis and Tudor is one of our high priorities.
Well, good luck with your assembly meeting tonight, and hopefully you'll get out before midnight.
Thank you very much.
Okay, so at this time, the chair will entertain any questions for the panel. I think Representative Wyrup.
Rather than talking about all this money we want to spend on all these projects before we have it, I'd rather talk about the basis for the premise. On the Mr. Condon's memorandum to you, Ms. Frasca, he indicates that the reasons for prompting enactment of the provision that's at issue here, that the sequestration provision became moot when all the issues in the case were settled in 95. So the legislature is free to repeal this statute that's sequestering these funds. And his concern is that if we repeal it, the oil companies or the producers or a gas company, if we develop a gas line, or ANWR, if we develop ANWR, will say, you can't put it in the permanent fund and sequester it because, see, they'll just pick it up later and it will benefit them eventually, so you really can't get a fair trial. Isn't there, since the cases that led to this fund that we're talking about here are moot now, they're resolved, there's nothing that prevents the legislature from repealing the statute and then reenacting it once this issue rears its head again in litigation, is it?
Through the other, Mr. Chair. Representative Wyrock, you're correct. Certainly the legislature has the authority to repeal it or change it at this time, but we're concerned about the precedent it might set for the future when we are in disputes over taxes with the oil industry or the gas industry, and we make this promise that, well, we'll corner it off, sequester it, and it won't count towards a dividend, but how can they trust us in the future? So that's a concern that we have. If we change what was agreed to before our settlement was reached, laws were passed, and then we, 15 years or so later, we change it.
So even though the litigation was settled in 95, and even though there may be some benefit, it's the future potential small benefit that a potential juror or judge may receive from that potential future income stream that we're worried about? That's it?
That's it.
Okay. The other question I have is maybe for Mr. Bhutan, and maybe for Ms. Frasca, and that is, there's an FAQ sheet, frequently asked questions, on page 16 of the handout. And one of the, number 5 indicates that, or on this from the OMB, says, we have been told that the state credit rating will be downgrading if it tries to sell bonds before recurring revenues match recurring expenditures. Since the state still doesn't have a fiscal plan, won't this issuance result in a downgrade? And the answer essentially is no, it won't. A couple of questions on that. Number one, it's really frustrating to be told over and over and hear over and over that we don't have a, quote, fiscal plan, and recurring revenues don't meet recurring expenses, and oh, if we just develop our resources, we'll be fine and dandy in the future. And let's spend the CBR, let's spend the earnings reserve of the permanent fund, and then develop our resources, and then we'll be fat and happy. But the fact of the matter is even if we spend out those funds, CBR and earnings reserve account, and even if we develop ANWR, and even if we develop the gas pipeline, there's still a gap in the future between now and when those things come online. And so it puts us in the boat of hearing on one hand, we don't need a fiscal plan because this isn't a problem, but on the other hand, we do go to another committee and we do need a fiscal plan. So I'm a little bit, I don't know what to make about all this.
Mr. Chairman, and I don't want to jump in front of Cheryl. I can certainly speak to the credit issue. This structure does successfully separate the Amerada Hess earnings from the general fund sufficiently that this doesn't cause the credit rating agencies to include this debt in general fund debt, and therefore, in their view, this isn't new debt from the standpoint of recurring revenues matching expenditures. And that was our goal, is to come up with a structure that distinguished these earnings well enough that this would not be general fund debt and would not then run afoul of this recurring revenues matching expenditures. And the story is that simple.
Well, I understand that, but it's really the philosophic issue I'm getting at, and that is the public isn't benefited, I don't think, when they see millions of dollars able to be spent on capital projects. Oh, because we found this little fund we can do, and at the same time told that we have a fiscal problem that requires some sort of scheme to have recurring expenses and recurring revenues. I mean, it's a difficult disconnect to educate the public on that and to get buy-in by the legislature.
Well, and I will say, Mr. Chairman, and looking at through the chair, looking at this conceptually, this Amerada Hess money isn't hardly at all invested in Alaska now, and securitizing this Amerada Hess earnings in this way does bring benefit to Alaskans, beginning right now and for the Alaska generation that's coming to get some benefit out of this right now, and frankly, that's something that credit rating agencies talk about in the context of public finance. So that's a comment I would make.
Two questions, Mr. Chairman.
Did you have a follow up to that question?
And I would like to, and Representative Weyer, through the chair. You know, we appreciate the disconnect, and we spent a great deal of effort the last year. Working to have a fiscal plan, and we appreciate the work that the House did to get there. So the challenge we have is the balance. Do we then go on hold in terms of building the state's infrastructure in anticipation, of course, as Mr. McKinnon mentioned, a number of these projects are in anticipation of the gas line. Do we go on hold in meeting some of the basic infrastructure needs? Do we go on hold in terms of not repairing state facilities? And so we chose to say, no, we want to, if there's an opportunity to meet some of those needs, we want to do that. But you're right, it sends a mixed signal to the public because they don't distinguish between what's the source of the funds. And it looks like we have construction dollars going out there, it's money. And we appreciate the quandary, but we decided that we need to take action instead of treading water for another year or two. And so that is for that reason we advance these proposals. We think there's a number of good results that we get, but we still recognize the challenge of how we, in the public's mind, and some of the legislature, recognize how we connect the need to bring our recurring revenues in line more with what our recurring expenses are. So we appreciate the challenge that you're leading in another one of your committee responsibilities.
One more question, Mr. Chairman. Somebody asked me a pretty good question at a forum, and that is, gee, all this information on this fund is now coming to light this year, and this has been around for a long time, and it hasn't been discussed, and why now? And the House passed the bond bill last year. We got this very strong message we wouldn't do any bonding until we had some sort of fiscal plan. Well, now we're doing bonding because we happen to find this fund this year. How many more funds are there out there like this that we can tap into?
Let's take that. If we told you, Mr. Chairman, we'd have to kill you. So, with all seriousness, 2 years ago, I didn't know about this either. And so it was more recent information. We'd have to ask who did know. And perhaps the Department of Revenue. But and I think the proposal, we spent a great deal of time on how to structure this so not to impact the state's debt rating. And that was a primary concern. And so we spent a tremendous amount of energy doing that. And I think that's what distinguishes it from what was before you last session.
Okay. Anything else for Representative Stoll? Representative Stoll.
Well, this will probably be quick. Earlier, I guess late in last year, one of the initiatives floated that was coming from filtering from Juneau was this fund was a funding source for a project that the governor and the mayor were working on together for a Capitol building. Is that off the? And then I just heard on the new, on the state sponsored program the other day, the press guy that does the show for the governor said the governor's still committed to building a Capitol building. So, are there any surprises in store here for us later down the line? Where is the administration on this building and its funding source?
Through the chair, Representative Stoltz, funding for a new Capitol building is not part of the projects that we proposed in our package. And ultimately, the final decision regarding what projects do get funded will be the legislature's in terms of what comes out of here. So there is nothing in here for that purpose.
So, Mr. Chairman, just while we're sitting here, can you state on behalf of the administration that this would be an inappropriate use of funding for the Capitol building?
Through the chair, there is a definition of what kinds of projects can be used with bond proceeds. And I believe a new Capitol building, as any building, would be an appropriate use of bond proceeds. The question of if it's
I'm not
that
talking
project,
legally, I'm talking morally.
That's a decision that the legislature will ultimately recommend to the governor.
The administration has no opinion? That's a rarity.
I think they want to build the castle in the valley. So
yeah, okay. That's fine.
okay, let's move on here. Representative Crouch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple of questions on the nature of this debt, and then a couple on the Emerald has legal challenge. On the debt, the Alaska Constitution Article 9, Section 8 requires that any state debt be put up for a vote, any general obligation. But it says no state debt shall be contracted unless ratified by a majority of the qualified voters, and it exempts out only sort of emergencies, repelling invasion, suppressing insurrection, defending the state in time of war, meeting natural disasters, or redeeming indebtedness that was outstanding at the time the Constitution was written. Why isn't this, with this borrowing, this $343 million, within that prescription and required that there be a public vote?
Through the chair, the earnings.
Repelling invasion?
I hope not. The earnings that are contemplated to be the source of the debt service for this in this debt structure are subject to appropriation. Go ahead and say further. If the revenues of the fund were going to be pledged, then indeed that would require, I believe. And I'm not an attorney, but I'm absolutely certain that would require then going to the voters in order to pledge those revenues out to the maturity of the debt, just as is done with general obligation debt.
If I might add to that, through the chair, the corporate structure that we're using here, the facilitator of the money flowing to this corporation will be operating leases. And so there will be an annual appropriation on an operating lease to provide for a transfer from the Alaska Capital Income Account to the Alaska Capital Corporation. If you look at other entities within the state, you could fairly easily pull up an image of AHFC and their ability to issue AHFC general obligation debt without a vote of the general population. And so you're talking about maybe something that you could relate to that.
Okay, so the theory is this isn't state debt under this constitutional provision because it's not state debt, it's debt of the corporation, and that somehow is significant enough to get it outside of this prohibition.
Through the chair, Representative Krupp, yes.
And I take it the same idea applies when we confront this idea that the governor's articulated that no more state debt would be allowed because that would affect our bond rating, that somehow we're operating under the idea this isn't state debt, it's Alaska Capital Corporation debt, and therefore it's okay constitutionally and okay with Wall Street.
Well, and through the chair, if the Amerada Hess earnings had been appropriated each year to the general fund, then credit rating analysts would be saying, oh, wait a minute, you're going to divert some money that's been used each year for the general fund spending to debt, and so we think that this is general fund debt. But of course, that hasn't been the case. Amerada Hess earnings have not been part of general fund income, and that's the distinction in the question that you asked.
Any other question?
Mr. Chairman, through the chair, Representative Krupp, the governor's concern is to protect the state's bond rating. And so there are certain kinds of debt that you could issue that could have a potential to impact the state's bond rating, and that's what he wants to avoid. And this, in this case, reconstructure debt, the tobacco tax securitization, which a legislature did several years ago, again used a corporate structure to sell bond, didn't require vote of the people, and did not impact the state's bond rating. So there's a number of ways that you can incur debt without it impacting your bond rating, which is what the governor's concern was.
A couple more, thank
sure.
you. Just trying to understand the basis for it. So if this had gone to the general fund, and if by bonding we had diverted some things that we were normally spending on general fund, thereby by bonding, try to bond our way out of our gap between expenses and revenues, that creates the Wall Street problem. If this had been used for GF and we were going to bond and thereby get out of that GF hole, that's what we want to avoid to keep our credit rating solid.
Yeah, you're exactly right, through the chair.
And so now I understand that aspect. Isn't it true that this $343 million of bonding is going to replace in the capital budget a lot of AHFC and ADA and some student loan money that we were using for capital? And in that sense, we're using this bond to replace GF or GF-like holes in both the operating, but more likely the capital budget that we've used before, to the tune of those combined in the $40 to $50 million.
Through the chair, Representative Krupp, we have in our capital proposal, in addition to these projects funded through this mechanism, another $121 million in proceeds from AHSC student loan and general funds. We've got $24.3 million in AHSC, $59.1 million in student loan, and $38.2 million in GF. And if you look at historically, $110 million has been about the state-funded part of the capital budget. So it what we're doing is we are adding to what's available for capital projects.
You're not supplanting with this bond.
Right.
And on the idea of, to that second issue, then, on the idea that there was something that biased the entire jury and judge pool of the state if we got a 5 or 10, I guess it started at $10 and maybe got higher later, but a $10 benefit through the dividend, isn't that an idea that we ought to fight against? The idea that you can't have a jury in Alaska, that it has to be a jury in Arizona determining our natural resource issues? Wasn't the legislature premature, and shouldn't we have waited for a decision on that? Because it's, to me, a fundamentally offensive one, that a $10 change in the dividend means you can't have any Alaskan determining any of these issues.
Through the chair, Representative, I'm not going to second guess the legislature whether it was 10 years ago or today. Well, maybe today.
Yeah, different group. Yeah.
To the extent that there was that benefit, I don't buy that it's a significant enough benefit to have disqualified us. But to the extent that that benefit was, Mr. Brotan said a moment ago that these projects provide a direct benefit to the state of Alaska. How is it different, legally, theoretically, in principle, to say we can never use it for dividends because that might be a bias because it's a benefit to people of $10 or $20 in their dividend, but we can now use it for roads and buildings all across the state that clearly will be a benefit? And why wouldn't the litigants in the Amerada Hess, the oil company litigants, have as much of a problem with us using it later for capital as using it in the dividend itself?
Want to take a shot at that, or do you want legal counsel?
Go ahead.
Well, I really do think that that's a question for the attorneys, but I will say, remember, we're securitizing the earnings of this Amerada Hess money, and that might be a distinction.
Okay. I do have a couple more. No, I'm trying to stay.
That's fine. I think you and as the rest of us now realize why this has got a judiciary
right.
Committee referral.
I'm not trying to argue. I'm just trying to understand, okay. And we sure. Can save the argument for later. There was a reference in the charts to a moral obligation, and both of you use the phrase or the idea that somehow this wasn't state debt or wasn't debt that would be counted by Wall Street because it was simply a moral obligation of the corporation, not, I take it, a legal or legally binding one. So we could really, the fiction or the idea is really that because it's subject to appropriation or a moral obligation, we could tomorrow, next year decide we're not paying this, and they just take that risk, and that itself wouldn't affect our bond rating?
Mr. Chairman, I think that's, we've got to segment that question. The moral obligation is a term of art, and it's used throughout the United States by states and subdivisions, and it's the language that has the commissioner, in this case, well, it would have the executive director of a corporation or the commissioner of a department committing to come to the legislature if a reserve fund or some other kind of fund fell below a certain amount, be it annual debt service amount or some other amount stated in the bond documents, and that's called the moral obligation and understood throughout the United States to be a level of commitment. The state of Alaska has used this device, this moral obligation, for a variety of different kinds of debt, the student loan corporation debt, the municipal bond bank debt, some Alaska housing program debt. Some Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority debt has carried the moral obligation. The moral obligation has never been called upon in the case of the state of Alaska. That is, the legislature has never been asked to fill up this, whatever, the reserve fund or whatever the example might be. So the state's moral obligation has never been called upon, but it's a backstop. And in this structure, because earnings of the Amerada Hess Fund can't be, the earnings rate can't be guaranteed, there's certainly potential volatility in the earnings rate, the moral obligation is an important backstop, considering the volatility of earnings. Contrast it with, say, the Alaska International Airport revenue bonds or the international airport system. There's a commitment that the state will collect rates and fees adequate to make the debt service payments. So that's a backstop. But there's no mechanism here where the state could guarantee what the earnings will be on the Amerada Hess fund. So a replacement backstop, if you will, is this moral obligation. And it's a very well understood and recognized credit out there. I see here that on June 30, 2004, State of Alaska moral obligation debt outstanding was $1,145 million outstanding. So it's a very well understood credit.
Representative Croft, can we go on to
if you'll come back?
Yeah, we'll come back. Representative Hopper.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Croft was headed in a direction I wanted to ask a couple of questions on. And again, re-plowing a very little bit of former ground here, but it is your intention that this would be classified, the whole business of having a reserve fund that the legislature may appropriate the needed requirement into each year would put this very clearly, solidly in the category of moral obligation debt.
Through the chair, certainly when the state categorized its debt next after the issuance of this debt, whatever amount had been issued would be includable as state moral obligation debt.
Just reiterating very clearly, not general obligation debt that would require a vote of the public.
And not general fund debt. As you know, and through the chair, there are categories of general fund debt to which this pledge of no new debt until recurring revenues match expenditures apply. There is general fund debt, which is not general obligation debt, and this will not be general fund debt, but you're certainly right, it will be moral obligation debt.
And not state-supported debt like AHFC. A very different mechanism still.
Through the chair,
as AHFC bonds require funding through.
I can't think of an AHFC program that is state support is
state guaranteed.
Yeah, state guaranteed, but state supported debt. I can't think of AHFC, a category of AHFC debt which is state supported debt, but there may be
one. Actually, and with apologies, I meant say state guaranteed.
Oh, okay. Well, certainly the Veterans Mortgage Program debt of the AHFC is state guaranteed debt.
Yeah, very much. So with that, so we're looking at, in fact, what you've discovered here is the argument we make is there is a new source of revenue available to the general fund that we didn't have before, didn't avail ourselves of, and that is what gives us the opportunity to take that new source of revenue that we didn't have before, essentially go to Wall Street, make the argument that we've got new general fund revenues, and it's would be the basis for the issuance of this moral obligation debt without an impact on our other credit rating. Is that basically the sort of the
well,
theory here?
Sure. I mean, it's just I'm not going to quibble with you about semantics. That's the basis upon which this will not impact the state's credit rating.
Okay. Well, maybe you need to quibble with me because I'm looking. We've basically identified new general fund revenues that we're using to take this debt package to Wall Street.
Well, Mr. Chairman, not to quibble. I haven't heard the Amerada Hess earnings called new general fund revenues, but indeed the fact that they're not general fund revenues is the basis upon which this is not general fund debt.
If I might add through the chair, the funds would never go to the general fund. They would go to the sub account and the earnings reserve and flow from there directly to the corporation, so bypassed.
Yes, once again, I'll be back. You made a comment earlier that the Amerada Hess earnings are not earnings of the general fund. Amerada Hess subaccount is part of a permanent fund, is it not? I'm looking for an answer.
Yes.
Amerada Hess is an application of permanent fund and does not then Article 9, Section 15 of the permanent fund say all income from the permanent fund shall be deposited in the general fund? Does that not make it general fund earnings?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hawker, I think the statute now directs this to be reinvested in the principal. This is handled differently than the other earnings of the fund.
C- so it's handled. Yeah, it's, so you're saying that it's handled other than is recommended or is mandated by the Constitution?
I'm not following the question.
I'll read the line. You just said that it's handled other than being deposited in the general fund. Yes,
it is not available for distribution.
Correct.
So it is then reinvested in the principal of the fund.
But is it not still general fund income that by law we are making a general fund appropriation annually to reinvest that money in the principal of the permanent fund?
I guess that's done automatically by the previous statute.
If I may.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hawker, well, what I'm looking at here is this little handy-dandy fiscal summary as we categorize money, and it seems that you're suggesting that we move what's currently been categorized as permanent fund earnings that are spent from other funds to the general fund column? Is that
well, actually, I'd argue that that's a worksheet. I'm looking, we're talking about the underlying substance here. I mean, it's...
this is... So you're saying this is just a worksheet, and... Isn't this how we've all been tallying these monies up until 3:15 today?
No, I wouldn't agree with that at all. We're just moving on, or really headed here, is that you are looking for a source that was not previously general fund money available to fund these bonds. Wouldn't finding other new general fund income be an equally valid source of repayment for these for this proposed bond issuance?
Yeah.
Or is this the only way we can get? Is this the only way we can issue this type of bond? Could we use other general fund earnings if they were without impairing the state's credit rating? Could we use other general fund earnings if we identified new general fund earnings that did not exist before you went to the market to request a bond?
Through the chair, speaking hypothetically, if there's some other fund out there, Fund X, that we don't know about, and it has earnings that are not now includable on worksheets in the general fund, could we securitize that without it impacting general fund credit ratings? Hypothetically, yes, we could.
So I guess what I'm kind of coming around to there is, in the past 2 years in this legislature, I can't add them up, but we've imposed new general fund revenues well in excess of $30 million. I'm wondering, so why do we have to go and utilize this source of money rather than going and saying, look, we've raised taxes effectively in this state well over $30 million in the last 2 years, and that has given us the additional capacity to bond? I guess I'm not that must have been a rhetorical question. So let's ask another question, if I may.
I think he's just up the panel.
Do you truly believe that taking these earnings is the highest and best use of this asset that sits within the permanent fund?
Through the chair, Representative Hawker, frankly, we'd have to reflect on the challenge of meeting what is the highest and best use. We do think this is an opportunity to leverage monies that previously, as Mr. Burns described it, the self-licking ice cream that did not contribute to Alaska's economy, whether on an individual basis or on the public good. We think that our proposal advances some investment in our infrastructure that we have not had the opportunity to do in a long time. If the legislature has other ideas about how we can achieve a higher and better use, we'd be glad to talk to you about it. But this was our proposal. It's a self-supporting way of leveraging these dollars. We thought it was a good idea, but again, we're glad to talk about other higher and better uses based on the legislature's perspectives.
And if I want one concluding,
okay,
here, I'm not sure. I was going to ask, but I won't this time, whether highest and best today is going to be the same conclusion tomorrow and the same for the next 20 years, because we're talking about taking this asset off the table for 20 years here. But let's look to the projects you're proposing to fund here. And I'm wondering, there's $300 excess million dollars of capital projects. Does this money complete all those projects, or does this money commence projects that will require additional funds to complete? That I'm wondering where that issue of sustainability of the needed completion funding. And for the example that sticks in my mind, is the science complex in Anchorage. You're looking at $21 million. My understanding is that's a $60 million plus project to complete. So we invest $20 million here to get the thing up, you know, next step. Where's the sustainable source of future, you know, bond capacity or debt capacity to complete the project? And is that the only, you know, that's only one example in here. How much of this is starting projects that we don't have the ability to sustain and complete?
Through the chair, Representative Hocker, that's a very good question. And we'd be glad to go back and do an analysis. But part of the, and what we would have to do is for phase two or three of the science building, that if that's a priority today, we're committing future capital dollars for it going forward so we complete the project. And that's part of the trade-offs you have to make as you're putting together a capital budget, as the legislature will experience. And that's part of what we go through when we make the decision today that, at least in our term, we're going to have to pledge to continue funding that project beyond just the 1 year. There are some projects in here that we've proposed, especially on the roads to resources, that this certainly doesn't complete the project since they're primarily EIS studies. But we also think there's some other ways to finance some of these projects in terms of construction. It doesn't always have to be the state doing it. So there are some other opportunities out there. But we'd be glad to go back through and look at that in terms of what you've suggested. What are we making, you know, 50%, a quarter of the way, and what are we doing to obligate for future to fully construct a project?
I guess I'd only ask you to be mindful that there's a long way for this to go through the body. I wouldn't ask for any paper response here, but just thoughts and concerns. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Hocker. And I think that's a very good question. It would be good to see which projects the money's proposed will actually start and complete versus just phase one or phase two of the project.
Yeah. And Mr. Chairman, I mean, that is the challenge of, you know, building a capital budget. I mean, if you don't take step one, you're never going to get to the end. So if we just want to, again, tread water, you know, that's an option. But again, we want to invest in the future. And if you don't start doing it today or by 10 more Saturdays of this session, then we won't be able to get to step two.
All right, very good. See, Representative Weirich has had a question, but he's left, so we'll go to Representative Croft.
Referring to your materials that you handed out, Cheryl, on page 12, well, for anyone there who wants to, which is a spreadsheet on the outflows of the Capital Corporation Construction Fund. It looks like my original idea of this was that $343 million was going to be spent, you know, next year. But it looks like it's bonded and then paid out over about a six-year period. Am I reading the project cash flow right, that it'd be $20 million actual outlaid in 06, 88 in 07, and on through until that fund balance was spent? It's bonded next year, but spent over the next 6 years.
Well, this is one example through the chair. This is what has been put together here by Department of Revenue is just one possible example of how the earnings and the timing of the debt issuance might work. If the earnings results in the near years were very dismal, we got into a bear market, then that would be a scenario where the issuance would have to be extended over a period of time. Again, we have this volatility of the earnings stream, which we are securitizing. And so what's in this packet is just one example of how this could work, but we are relying upon the earnings of a fund that they can't be predicted.
Well, I'm not talking about page 11 is the securitization. I understand that may stretch depending on how much you get. I guess you get a certain amount. It'll take more or less years to pay off depending on how the market operates. But the concept is we would bond immediately and pay out over some discrete 5, 6, 7 year period of time, sort of as those bills came due on different projects.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Right. And then finally on page 18 of your materials, it has A and B on the bottom. How does this proposal square with the governor's promise to not touch the permanent fund without a public vote? I take it that's OMB's. Is that? It's on an OMB spread or publication, but is that OMB's interpretation of the commitment that's out there, the governor's commitment to not touch the permanent fund without a public vote?
Correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Croft. Any other questions for our panel? The panel's shrinking. We're wearing you down a little bit. So it's our committee's all ahead. Okay, seeing no other questions, thank you for the presentation, the overview, and assuming the bill gets out of judiciary, we'll see you again.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. We appreciate it.
Thanks. Okay, is there anything else that needs to come before the House Finance Committee? If not, we'll be meeting tomorrow, same time, taking up two bills, House Bill 81, which is the contractor license enforcement, and then Senate Bill 60, which is to extend the Suicide Prevention Council, and bills previously heard. I don't know if we have any coming up or not, but and a couple on Monday that are being held over. If they're ready, we'll take them up. If not, we won't. And Thursday, you set up an overview, did you, Mr. Chairman? With the University of Alaska on the biomedical research projects. And then after that, we'll continue on with the supplemental appropriations. So, with that, anything else? We're adjourned.